Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Media revolutions have happened before. The alphabet, the printing press, radio, television. But the digital media revolution, says Douglas Rushkoff, is different. The digital revolution is touching almost every corner of our lives, he says, shaping and framing those lives. In effect, he says, if we're not careful, programming us. This hour On Point, program or be programmed, media theorist Doug Rushkoff's call for humans to be masters of their own digital destiny. Joining me now from New York is Douglas Rushkoff. He's in the tradition of big media thinker Marshall McLuhan, best-selling author, creator of documentaries The Merchants of Cool, The Persuaders, and Digital Nation. His new book is Program or Be Programmed, 10 Commands for a Digital Age. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Douglas Rushkoff, thanks for being here. Welcome.
No, thanks so much for having me.
Here you are, early enthusiast of the digital revolution, early acolyte, and now you're writing, we have surrendered the unfolding of a new technological age to a small elite who have seized the capability on offer. We're too busy wading through our overflowing inboxes to consider how they got this way. What's going on?
No, I think people are, and maybe necessarily, they're taking a passive stance toward their media, toward their digital media, where we're accepting the programs that we use pretty much as they're written and as if they were pre-existing conditions, just the way to do things, rather than recognizing that there are, you know, people and companies with ideas about how we should work and live who contextualize our activity by writing the programs that we use.
We don't, most of us anyway, sort of rebuild our automobiles or our microwave ovens or, you know, a zillion other things that we use all day, every day. But you say we should get up to our elbows in the digital programming side. Why?
Well, ideally, yeah. I mean, it's funny, the analogy between, and I hear a lot of people say this, oh, I drive my car, but I don't know how to fix the engine. No, and I understand that. And I'm not asking that people become auto mechanics, you know, relative to their computers. What I'm saying is it's not really the difference between driving a car and knowing how to fix it, but driving a car and being just a passenger in the car. It's really the difference between driver and passenger I'm looking at. So I'm not saying that someone needs to know how to open up their computer and change the hard drive and work on the power supply and fix the display, but that programming actually is the language of a digital medium. You know, and when we got spoken language, you know, people didn't just learn how to listen, they learned how to speak. When we got text, people didn't learn just how to read, they learned how to write. And now that we get computers, I feel that people should learn not just how to use programs, but how to make them, or at least how to know, and that's really what I try to do in this book, at least how to understand what the programs that we're using are for. Now, I feel like people will get much more predictable results out of their technologies if they know simply what the programs, what the technologies they're using were made to do. You know, who made them? Why did they make them? What is its purpose? So that you really don't end up being used by it more than you're a user of it.
We'll look at your 10 commands, but paint a picture for us, Douglas Rushkoff, of this digital realm you see as being woven around us that people may come to mistake for, you know, the fundament for gravity and the speed of light, but rather it's this created thing. Paint a picture of that, the thoroughgoing quality of that.
Well, it is interesting. I mean, where I was wrong was not in being enthusiastic about these technologies. I still am. I think this is the biggest thing since text. Mm-hmm. I think this is big. Where I was wrong was I thought that kids raised in the digital landscape, you know, the people I call digital natives or screenagers, I thought that they would come to speak digitality and use digital devices like natives, that it was okay that we had only a partial understanding because, you know, we were immigrants to this space, but that kids would really get it.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we were making the Frontline documentary for PBS called Digital Nation, were interviewing lots and lots of kids about their relationship to technology. And they would, you know, I'd ask them, you know, so what's Facebook for? And they would say, well, Facebook was made to help me make friends. And I thought, you know, that's such a quaint, sweet understanding of Facebook. You know, and if you go to the boardroom at Facebook, they're not sitting wondering, how are we going to help little Johnny make better friends? They're thinking, you know, how are we going to monetize his relationships? How are we going to create an opportunity for marketers to create what they call, you know, peer-to-peer dialogue or word-of-mouth reputation and viral currency and all these things about products and brands. So what I realized was that kids growing up with digital media all around them naturally accept it as a given circumstance. You know, it reminds me of when, you know, I grew up in New York City, mm-hmm. and I just thought cities had grid patterns. We took a trip when I was in junior high school. We went to Paris. And I suddenly saw, oh, my gosh, you mean they could make a city with round and curved streets? I didn't know you're allowed. I didn't know that happened because I thought the grid somehow, naively, I thought the grid was just the way it was. And I feel like kids are growing up now with these technologies, and many of us, that we see them as pre-existing conditions of the universe, almost as nature, without realizing that they're biased, that they're tilted, that the people who made these programs, or in many cases the programs that made these programs, had particular ideas about what kinds of behaviors and activities were going to happen in them, and that accepting these limits as given circumstances rather than as arbitrary limits, I think makes us much more reactive to our programmed universe than we are creative or constructive.
Take it on beyond Facebook. It's not just friendship we're talking about here, or, you know, ersatz friendship, Facebook style. You're sort of painting a picture that gets into many more, increasingly more aspects of the digital realm we live through.
Well, right. I mean, it is different from, say, you know, it's one thing to not know how your automobile works. It's just really conveying you from place to place. You know, not knowing how your digital interfaces work, not knowing how your basic communications language is structured and why, it really means that you don't know what you're seeing and what you're not. You know, this is the technology through which we are expressing ourselves, through which we are coming to understand the world we are living in.
It's look at Google in those terms as well.
Well, absolutely. You know, if you think of the world's information as basically one Google search away, then, which on the one hand it is. I mean, don't get me wrong. Google mm-hmm. is powerful and great. I love Google. But when you think about if that's what you think information is, well, then you think of information as this thing that you kind of cast out for and get a result. You mm-hmm. no longer think of information as an inquiry, as a kind of a journey through a discipline or through a history of knowledge. You think of it as you just get this sort of pinpoint accuracy on the bit of data that you want without context, without whatever its historical context or the way that information what was developed, you know, which is democratizing on the one hand. I think that's great that anybody can find out, you know, well, what are the medications being used for this cancer? What did this guy say at that moment in history? And that's all great. But just because we have that piece of information doesn't mean we really know how to use it. It doesn't mean that we're really the masters of that information.
It doesn't mean that's all the information there is. It's just what Google pointed us to.
Right. It's just what Google pointed us to. And so far, anyway, it feels like we can trust Google to point us to the right information. You know, and so far we can trust, and it's fine. I mean, Wikipedia is in some sense a better example because at least it's a big collaborative mm-hmm. effort. You know, Wikipedia is made up of people who understand the system that they're using and they understand the biases of it, that there's this competition for, you know, whose data is considered to be the right data and who's considered balanced. When you basically surrender all of your information gathering to one corporation, I'm not saying that we can't trust them and maybe it's fine and maybe they're really more of a public utility than they are a corporation, but I don't know. You know, they still have shareholders. It's still one place.
And it's coming to a kind of head now, you say. We're sort of through the introductory little chapter here to the digital world. You say we're coming to a moment that really matters in these terms.
Well, I think it does. I mean, I feel like there's a turning point ahead in that the technologies are getting just complex enough, just distant enough from us that you can pretty much live in a digital world without knowing how any of it works. You know, back in the old days, you know, using a computer and programming a computer were the same thing. You know, it's because programming was so easy and using was so command-based and so transparent that you just had this thing called a computer and you told it what to do and it did it. You know, you decided it would, today it's going to be a word processor. Tomorrow it's going to be this. It just modeled whatever you wanted to do. And now, you know, kids don't learn computers in school. They learn software. You know, now we get a computer that pretty much does everything it's supposed to do out of the box, and we don't really have to know, or we're not supposed to know how to get it to do anything different. And I feel like once we stop relating to computers as highly configurable devices, as tools that we embed with our purpose, then we will lose sight of quite what they are and really relinquish our authority over them.
And how, you say, they may be programming us. Douglas Rushkoff, please stand by in New York. The new book is Program or Be Programmed, 10 Commands, and we'll hear them for a digital age. I'm Tom Ashbrook with Douglas Rushkoff. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Doug, lots of feedback here. First of all, just a lot of fans of yours. Huge fan of Rushkoff here on Facebook. It says, as a high school social studies teacher, I've made Digital Nation a standard piece of the curriculum. Gotta love that, I'm sure, Doug.
That's sweet. Yeah. Now I'm the programmer.
Yeah, you're the programmer. But here's Richard who says, I'm comfortable under the hood of digital devices, and I don't really have a problem with hoods that don't open. Yes, this is taking some control away from users, but so far it hasn't bothered me in the least. There's one. And here's another. G says, the problem as I see it arises when the up-and-coming generation of youngsters just take the existing technology for granted, not knowing what exactly does their membership entail. When every single search you make from your computer can be linked back to you, provide others with a profile of you, that's scary to me. To them, it's a given. Here's my question for you, Doug. You say, in a way, I mean, you want us to be able to get in there and, you know, change the digital framework, but you also say the digital framework is changing us and a lot of our behaviors. How so?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, people always change based on what technologies we have. You know, the invention of speech changed the brain. The invention of text and reading changed our brains. And now, you know, the television changed us. And of course, digital technology will change us. I feel like digital technologies and 21st century technologies are different from industrial age technologies in that they are embedded with purposes. In other words, these technologies continue on after we set them in motion, whether it's digital technology or nanotechnology or robotic technology or even genetics. You know, those four technologies kind of characterize this 21st century range of technologies that get embedded with code and then replicate. They reproduce. They alter themselves. And they actually do, in some sense, fight for survival in an overall ecology, whether you're watching, you know, Monsanto seeds fight against the biological seeds, or whether you're watching, you know, Google fight against Apple, fight against Facebook. You're looking at programs really fighting for dominance. And I feel like all too often we set these things in motion, and even we don't really fully understand how they work, that even our programmers don't quite know what's going on. And I feel like if we don't get some handle on it, I don't know that, you know, that computers then completely take over and we become slaves. I mean, that's almost the kind of thinking that goes along with this sort of very polar, digital, panic-driven, you know,
program or be programmed. Sure sounds right down that alley to me.
It does. I mean, it does. It does. But I actually mean that not just in a digital sense, but in a cultural sense. You know, for me, it's like either we leave things the way they are, or they get to get much, much better right now. You know, for me, my first computer experience, my first real networked experience, I saw the world completely differently from that moment on. I saw, oh my gosh, we're all connected. in this, we're building a global brain. We have this ability now to do something humanity has never done before. And I looked at the rest of the world differently. I understood, oh my gosh, look at how much of the rest of the world is programmed. In other words, not digitally, not with computers, but our institutions, our language, our money, our economy, our religions, mm-hmm. you know, that all of these things I took for granted as just given circumstances were made, were creations of people. And that's this great insight. And it was, in some sense, it was the insight that the ancient Israelites had when they invented or they got text, the 22-letter alphabet, and they write a contract with God and write their own laws, and they realize, oh my gosh, we are in charge of this world. I had a similar insight with digital technology, and I think those of us that had the opportunity to use some of those early interfaces saw, oh my gosh, this really could change the game. You know, no longer do we need to be 90% illiterate, driven by a 10% elite who use good public relations to get us to buy their bad programs. Now we can actually participate in a much more literate and articulate way. And I feel like that window of opportunity is closing. You know, I look at other countries. I look at, India and China, where they're teaching kids programming when they're in elementary school because they understand that this is the language of the 21st century. And I look at us even in high school, and we're just teaching kids Microsoft Office, and we think we're giving them workplace skills for the jobs of today. And maybe we are, but we're not giving them the critical thinking tools and the engineering skills and the programming skills that they're going to need to compete in both the marketplace and even the military of tomorrow.
Program or Be Programmed is the book and the idea. Let's see if we can get to those callers who lined up for you. Hanksville, Vermont. Jamie, you're on the air with Douglas Rushkoff.
Thank you.
What's your thought, Jamie?
Well, I was listening earlier in the show about is the information we're getting, say, from Google, Wikipedia, et cetera, good information? And I think back to when I opened up the Encyclopedia Britannica and read the Chicago Tribune to do school reports. Mm-hmm. And when I look at my daughter going to Google today, I don't see it as any different except that she has a much greater breadth of information available to her. My father, on the other hand, thinks it's a poor source of information. To me, it's no different than who wrote Encyclopedia Britannica. My daughter isn't a writer. She may not be able to program a computer. She can access the information. No different than, I'm not a journalist, but I accessed information from the Tribune when I was a kid. And I just think it's a different way of doing it, but I think it's a much greater way of doing it.
Douglas, what do you say?
Well, when I was in school, if we used the World Book Encyclopedia or the Encyclopedia Britannica in one of our reports, even as early as junior high school, it'd be considered a failing grade, because the object of writing a report is not accessing information. A computer can access information and transcribe it into a document. That's not why we do research reports. The reason we do research reports is for the actual process of research. How do you find something out for real? How do you piece information together? You know, it's not the task of going on Google and getting the piece of info is fine as the beginning, but that's not the result. That's not
but
the candy.
But of course, Google gives you more than Wikipedia. I mean, you can go very deep in it. You can get all the way to academic treatises, I guess, the kind of thing your junior high school teacher would have been delighted to have you cite in a research paper.
You can get to them. That's absolutely true. That's true. If you go there. I mean, usually once you get to something that's that valuable, they try to make you pay for it. You'll see it's $4 to access or whatever it is. And Google can, but I think it's important that people understand that Google is a single point of reference. You know, that it's a way, it's a window, it's a great window. I've used it, and I've used Wikipedia, even in writing books. I mean, these are great, great resources. They're great starting places for inquiry, just as the library was a great starting place for inquiry before. I don't have a problem with the tools as long as people understand that it's the beginning and not the end. You know, but I feel like the bias of the technology right now is towards thinking of your result as the thing.
We'll frame the world, you'll live in it.
Right.
Jamie, thanks for your call. Let's get another. Barbara in Florence, South Carolina. Florence, you're on.
Hi. I was originally going to make the comment that I lost my email. I lost access to the internet, and I don't have access to my email, and I haven't missed it. what he brought up was really funny was, it reminds me, and this is proving my age because I'm 48, I remember Star Trek, and there was one called Court Martial where one of the characters is being court-martialed, and they're all using the computers to access information. And his lawyer, the Kirk's lawyer, is using old textbooks. And the wonder and the feel of being tactile and being able to feel that piece of paper and read the information off the piece of paper. And it's like, I agree with him up to a certain extent, but we have got to realize that the more advanced we become, the more complicated things can get. And because I no longer have access to my email, the true friends that I know of will give me a phone call versus sending me the email and saying, where are you?
And maybe even stroll over and see each other in person. Barbara, thanks very much for your call. I mean, Douglas Rushkoff, you put this in pretty tough terms at some points in here. You write, a society that looked at the internet as a path toward highly articulated connections and new methods of creating meaning is instead finding itself disconnected, denied deep thinking, and drained of enduring values. That sounds like a pretty terrible onslaught.
Well, I think it's because we are using most of these tools in really silly ways, you know, and it's hard. I mean, it's whether it's the person being so overwhelmed by email that they don't have time to visit with their friends, and then they think, well, what am I doing my email for? When I see, you know, when Sherry Turkle at MIT, you know, was doing research, she wanted to find out about, you know, how kids are too distracted and using too many devices at home. When she did interviews with families, she found out that it's kids, you know, 3 to 11 and 12-year-old kids who are complaining that their parents won't put their phones down to engage with them. And it's not the parents' fault completely. You have to understand that if you understand the biases of the technology, that your BlackBerry really is addictive, that it does have it's sort of the perfect ratio of good emails to boring or bad ones, that it makes it work like a one-armed bandit slot machine, that you keep coming back. Just, is there one good one there? Is there one good one there? When people don't touch their BlackBerry for 15 or 20 minutes, they start to get nervous.
But you're putting up something bigger than addiction here, you know, that metaphor. I mean, what you're saying, a society that finds itself disconnected, denied deep thinking, drained of enduring values. Give us examples of that. What do you mean by those? Those are pretty big charges.
Well, they are. I mean, first off, it's the extent to which our technologies encourage multitasking, which, you know, I for a long time wanted to believe that multitasking was really possible, that you could do more than one thing and have all these different windows open on the machine and be the master of this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all the research shows so far that multitasking just doesn't work. You know, the Cliff Nass at Stanford did a whole bunch of studies on kids who are you know, in their 20s who believe to be doing great multitasking and whose subjective experience of their productivity when they're multitasking is that it's better than when they're not. Yet every study is showing they're doing things, it's taking them more time, and they're doing it less accurately than when they do it end to end. And they're doing it with less deep thinking. You know, that when you've got an email window open behind the document that you're writing, you're not going to write as well. Your constructs are not going to be, your thought constructs aren't going to be as dimensional. It's just because you're in you're using a very limited part of your mind, of your awareness. You're flitting back and forth. And when you flit back and forth, when you move from Google to Twitter to your document to email to Google to Twitter to your document back to email, you're not giving your brain the extended periods of time it needs to do deeper thinking. Now, then you can argue, well, maybe we don't need deep thinking anymore. Maybe we don't need it to do these tasks. And that's okay. But I just want people to then go consciously and say, okay, I don't need that.
If I may, here's a question for you, Doug Rushkoff, from Adam Timma. He says, this is off Facebook, I'm a college professor at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, have been using your work, Doug Rushkoff, in my classes since I first saw Emergence of Influence in my during my master's degree, he says. I'm wondering what you think the link is between the technology and the way it has been branded through a very traditional advertising strategy. I mean, are these, you know, new masters of the universe saying, here's the universe, come and use it, and you don't need to worry about the rest. We'll do that.
Well, I mean, I think that's since about 1995. I do think there's been, and I don't know that it's so conscious, but I think there's been an effort to distance users from the workings of their technology. I think that most advertising people probably felt that regular people are afraid. You know, oh, it looks complex, there's a whole piece of technology, so let's get it as far away as possible. But what they succeeded in doing, really, was making the workings of these extremely simple tools and making things like programming, which is not hard to learn. It's really 2 weeks with a good book, and you'll know how to do it. A book, yeah. I'm so old school. Get a programming book pages from a publisher. Right. It's not that hard. But if you remember, like, when you have Microsoft Windows, for those of you who've ever used that, you know, you want to install a program on Windows. You know, what do you summon? You summon this thing called the wizard. You know, why do they call it the wizard? Why isn't it called the assistant, the plumber, the installer? It's called the wizard because the wizard means this is mysterious stuff and only the magical wizard can drag the application from the disk all the way to
and
the application.
Don't worry your pretty little head. But here, let me put this question to you. This is from a web comment. What he's asking of us is to become a society of technocrats. Your alarmist attitude doesn't really change the culture. Stanislaw Lem warned about the inevitability of our evolution into robots decades ago. Asking us to become programmers seems to me only to hasten that onset. It doesn't prevent anything. What do you say?
I think that if people understood how the technologies they're using worked, they'd be in a better position to use them consciously and effectively. It's just like if you know what a word means, then you're going to be able to use it better than if you don't. I don't know about, you know, technocrats is sort of a way, I mean, I see it as a way of kind of running the world through efficiencies and, and databases and structures. I think we're more likely to become technocrats if we let technology run us over, if we let our machines rule us, rather than looking and saying, when do I want to use this program to run my government? And when would I rather people do it? When do I want to use these technologies in a classroom? And when do I not? When do I want to bring my business online? And when do I not? And I feel like people are putting computers in their classrooms. And I believe that there should be computers and whiteboards and all that in classes. This is the thing. I'm a techno advocate. Mm-hmm. I just think they should be implemented consciously rather than nervously. I think they should be implemented intentionally rather than because we feel obligated to use some piece of technology because someone else is.
And don't just be what used by the software you think you're using. Program or be programmed is Douglas Rushkoff's new book. He's got 10 commands for a digital age in there. We'll come back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with media theorist, author, critic, documentary filmmaker Douglas Rushkoff. His new book is Program or Be Programmed, and he's looking about the role of humans and the digital realm that's supposed to serve them right now in the digital age. We've got a lot of people here to do that. Nick in Needham, Massachusetts. Nick, you're on the air with Douglas Rushkoff.
Hi. I'm a software engineer student who's about to graduate this May.
Great.
And I just wanted to call in because it seems to me thus far in the discussion there's kind of been this base assumption that software engineers are these sinister people that are trying to hide useful things from users and kind of have like nefarious motives. When really most of the time I think when things like the wizard are invented or other kind of software abstractions, what's really trying to happen is we're trying to make it so anyone can use a computer instead of just super educated elite. And it seems like we actually trust all kinds of professionals and give them the benefit of the doubt that they're doing the right thing, from doctors to even people like plumbers who we don't necessarily understand. And I wish we would kind of give software engineers the same type of benefit of the doubt, because I really do think they are trying to make the world better.
Nick, stick with us. Douglas Rushkoff, let's hear it. Respond, please.
Oh, I absolutely believe that. I mean, I think many, many programmers I know end up at a crossroads when, you know, when they work for one big corporation or another. I mean, if you're a great programmer. You know, the people who are going to pay you the most right now are, you know, Goldman Sachs to develop an algorithm to help them do, you know, super fast trades faster than someone else so that they can execute trades based on what you're about to do, literally, and kind of travel through time that way. And then they have to make a choice. Do I want to make software that, you know, that helps people do stuff and increases usability or not? And I do understand the elitist argument that it's like, well, look, you know, I'm asking for people to actually I'm on some level requiring people understand something about how this stuff works. And, you know, there was a great argument about this in the early 1900s between Walter Lippmann, the original public relations man, and John Dewey, who was an educator at Columbia. And Walter Lippmann basically said, look, democracy isn't even really possible in a country like America. All you can do is have a small elite understand policy and what happens, and they hire public relations people to get the masses to go along with it. And Dewey said, no, no, we can educate people enough that they could actually know enough about issues to elect to elect leaders consciously and with some purpose. And I understand this debate. It's possible that we are not kind of skillful enough and intellectual enough as a society to think critically about the technologies we use. But I think that would be a shame. I'm not asking that everyone know how programming work, and I'm not asking that people think that programmers are nefarious. I mean, maybe the investors in Facebook might be nefarious, but I know the programmers there and at Google. I think programmers are great people. I'm asking more of us to become programmers. But what I'm asking those of us who don't become programmers to be able to do is to think critically. That doesn't mean suspiciously. That doesn't mean in paranoid terms. It just means critically. What can I do in a Twitter window and what can't I do there? What can I do in a blog space and what can't I do there? Why does my why won't my iPad connect through Bluetooth to my iPhone? Is it because it can't or because it's been disabled? And who disabled it and why did they do that? It's really just looking at technologies from the perspective of their malleability, their openness to our intervention, rather than accepting them at face value all the time. No, the programmer that crippled my iPad is probably a good guy, right? And they told him to do that. They told him to turn off that part because, you know, they wanted to support AT&T or do something else. But I want users to at least know what they're buying, from whom, what they're using, and what it's for, and whether or not its limitations are programmatic limitations or business limitations.
Nick, thank you for your call. You know, I'm very sympathetic to what you're saying, Doug, but at the same time, I mean, as more and more of our life kind of migrates to the digital realm, and that is thoroughly engineered, as you say, nefarious or not, it's engineered. That means some things are included and some things aren't. Some outlooks, some perspectives are embedded and some things are not. As it takes over more and more of our activity, even into friendship and basic inquiry, you know, even if you're critically aware, how can you possibly avoid having your life more or less in significant degree framed by the imperatives of whoever's putting up the software?
Well, you can't. I mean, you can't, which is why, I mean, I would argue that this is as big as the invention of text. You know, when we got the invention of text in the Axial Age in maybe, 1100 BC, it changed everything. You know, it changed our relationship to God, that we ended up writing Torah and Bible, which is essentially a contract with God because we can get it down in writing. We started writing laws rather than just submitting to the law of the Pharaoh. The people got together, or some of them anyway, and wrote laws by which human beings were going to live. We developed ethics, but we also understood that there were going to be some serious problems in a text-based world. That now, if you had a contract that said you win, you get to win, even if it means your neighbor's now going to suffer, because it's in writing. You know, you've got it there. So now, in some sense, you're less ethically and less morally obligated. Now you can write something down, bad news, and leave before the person reads it. You don't have to look at them in the face.
Right.
Our whole world did change then, and it's going to change. It's going to change again now. But it doesn't mean that the world we've been living in is any more real, right, than the one we're going to go into now. You know, the world we're living in is is already very framed by all sorts of social constructions and laws and mores and ways of seeing things. You know, we think
yes,
of the stuff
but the
in
sources
our
of that
money.
Construction seem more diverse. I mean, Microsoft or Google are global in an instant, and then there's a global framework.
Right. I mean, which is exactly, and it happens fast, doesn't it? You know, Google changes some aspect of its search, so now we have live search to get the most recent results, and all of a sudden everybody's valuing what was just said about something more than the most important thing that might have been said, or the most deliberate thing that might have been said about something.
Let me, I want to go to your 10 commands. Let me set it up with this. Here's a comment from Keith. He says, as someone who's worked with both hardware and software, I can sympathize, but I think it's futile. People are too busy to figure out how everything works, and it's only getting harder as we're driven to be productive and our tools get more complex. So there's the note of skepticism.
Right. He's right.
You respond to that with your 10 commands.
You're right, and that's why I ended up writing, you know, 128 or 144-page book,
yeah.
You know, something this short that's like half a plane ride,
yeah.
So they can still watch the movie. And get the book.
Run us through
that's
these
why
10
I came
commands.
Up with commands.
Got,
right.
We've only got 9 minutes, so you don't even get a minute per
that's
command.
That's all right. Well,
let's
anyway, rather than writing commandments, which is the things that mm-hmm. we were supposed to follow when we got text, I'm writing commands, the idea is that these are commands that give you command of the Internet. These are commands for you to use, not necessarily follow. So
run
one of them,
in.
Each one has a bias. So the first bias in new media is time. Right? I believe that digital media exists outside time. The beauty of it was that you could use you could reply an email in your own time. So that my first command is do not be always on. In other words, don't put the iPhone on you, pinging you every time you get an email, or you're going to start getting phantom vibration syndrome,
right,
where you think your phone's vibrating in your thigh, even though it's not there. So do not be always on. The second one is the bias of place. Very simple. Live in person. You know, I've walked into classrooms where they have all the kids come into the class, log onto the computer, go into Second Life, and experience a simulation of the classroom they're already in. That's silly.
You're saying, you know, thou shalt not do from a distance what can be done in person.
Exactly.
I'm for that.
The third one is choice. And all I'm saying is you may always choose none of the above. That's really the third command, which means that sometimes you move into a world like a Facebook or somewhere where it says, you know, are you male or female? Are you this or that? You know, you have this illusion of more and more choice, but you're actually choosing between the predetermined slots in a database, which may have been created by a wonderfully open-minded engineer, but still doesn't include who you are. Complexity, and that's great for the democratic process. The fourth command is you are never completely right, which really just means it's very easy when you're using these tools because you have broadcast media's reach to think that you are as knowledgeable about a subject as someone who's actually maybe in the White House press corps.
If you're blogging or posting or whatever it may
be. When you're posting your link to something you saw on Huffington Post, which links to something in the New York Times, it doesn't mean that you don't have a right to do it, but it means that it can create the illusion that you're more informed to yourself. That you're more informed about the issues than you are.
Does that push back against the sort of the web will be the ultimate democratizing tool that was the mantra for in its early years?
It does, you know, and it's the web still can be as long as people don't equate this sort of web-based blogging with participatory democracy. In other words, blogging from the safety of your bedroom is not the same as actually making your community a better place to live. You know, in some cases, it's a poor substitute. The fifth command is one size does not fit all. It's about scale. You know, and this is really good for businesses. Everyone goes online and then thinks they've got to scale up and become everything to everybody. You know, it's very hard to think locally and specifically on the net, especially when you've got investors asking, how are you going to scale up and make this bigger and make it something else? There's this the abstractness to the net where everything's supposed to become everything. Like you are a music dealer and now you're supposed to be the aggregator of music dealers or now the aggregator of aggregators, and that just doesn't go on forever. Identity. There's a simple command, be yourself. At least be yourself whenever possible. Anonymous behavior. When you're anonymous and posting the comments on a blog or on an article, you're going to tend to be meaner than you are. And I would argue you're going to tend to be less who you really are. Then unless your life's really in jeopardy, unless you're in Iran, you know, say who you are and only invite people who are non-anonymous to participate in what you're doing. And you'll end up with a much higher level of
Thou shalt not be anonymous, okay?
Yeah. Social. The bias of social. I believe that this technology is still biased towards social activity. And the simple command for that is do not sell your friends. You know, you can go into one of these environments, one of these social networking environments, and you download a game or you start doing an activity that really becomes less about playing the game than getting everyone else to do it. It's like those self-help mm-hmm. seminars of the 70s where getting it meant getting 10 other people to do it.
Right.
You know, that's sort of the bias on a lot of these social networking sites is to get other people to join it too.
You say remember the individual humans.
Right. Remember the humans.
Mm-hmm.
The eighth bias I was looking at was fact. I believe the net is fact-based. Even when the facts aren't true, they're not. It's not mythologically based the way TV was. You know, it's not great for brand images. It's much better in a business sense for truth, for product attributes. What are you actually doing?
Mm-hmm.
If you want something to spread around on the net and have people tweet it, make it a fact, and people will actually tweet it. Openness, and this is just to deal with it. Everyone's so concerned with, you know, piracy. All I'm saying, share, don't steal. That's really the easiest way to think about it. Just share when you can, and don't steal from people who aren't sharing. And we don't have to worry about all of this insane copyright discussions. And finally, purpose. These technologies are biased towards purpose. These are not shovels. These are not rakes that just sit there. Everything digital is embedded with purpose, whether we know the purpose or not. And that's why I'm asking us to program or be programmed. And I don't just mean you have to become a computer programmer. I mean this from on a social perspective. This message, I think, would have been as applicable to Moses' era as our own, that this is an opportunity. It's funny. God says to Abraham in the Bible, you shall be as priests. And what he meant at the time was you will be literate. You know, only mm-hmm. priests knew hieroglyphs, priestly mm-hmm. writing. And I think we're at a point where, once again, we have an opportunity to think critically about the world we live in and to become the programmers, to have more people step over that line into what had been the position of the elite and become aware and conscious human beings acting with agency rather than just audiences selecting from the available choices.
Know or program, or at least probe the purpose of the digital realm you're in the midst of at any given moment. That is quite a list. You don't have it carved in stone, I suppose, in tablets, but we will put it up on our website with a link to how people can get the book as well. Joanna in Tewksbury, Massachusetts. Joanna, you're on the air with Douglas Rushkoff.
Thank you. I love your list, number one. I am a technical writer, and as such, you know, through all of my years, I've been an enormous advocate for simplicity because it usually means a better designed product and a thinner book. However, I think a lot of the products that people do use and a lot of social media are so well designed that indeed they do mean that people don't have to think about what they do. On the other hand, I don't need to know how my microwave works in order to appreciate and use it. So my bigger issue is the critical thinking that you're talking about and the way that these media have fragmented the way we interact. How isn't it really critical thinking in a broader sense that it's critical thinking in almost every area of our lives, and that this is a bigger issue than just thinking in terms of social media, that critical thinking in every area has to be learned and taught?
Don't be a drone, whatever realm you're in. What about it, Doug?
Absolutely. I mean, on the one hand, I understand the microwave argument, but I'm not asking that people know how to take apart their computers and fix the power supplies and fix the screen. I'm asking that people understand what the programs they're using are for. And I think most people, when they look at a microwave, they know, okay, I know what this is. This is something that's going to, you know, irradiate or whatever, or heat up the water in my food. It may or may not have something good or bad about it, what it does to the food. I know if I have a pacemaker, I shouldn't go near it. I know how to make it go for 3 minutes or 4 minutes. That is knowing how to use a microwave.
So what is Facebook for, Doug?
What Facebook is for is to monetize human relationships. What Facebook is for is to help people think of themselves in terms of their consumer profile, in terms of their likes and dislikes, to help people connect based on their product and cultural preferences that are selectable. You know, it's to help brands figure out ways to market themselves in a word-of-mouth fashion.
So if you look at it and say, this is for friendship, you're missing all that. It's for monetizing human relations, quite a different thing.
Right. I mean, and it might you might be able to use it to make friends, but then you have to look, is this the best way to make friends, you know, or is it just the default way to make friends? And that's all critical thinking is about, is and she's right. It's the history of our civilization is really our opportunities open up for people to begin thinking critically about the world they live in. And we either take them or we don't. And this is the opportunity of my lifetime. So I'm out there asking people to seize it.
Douglas Rushkoff, media theorist, we may say extraordinaire. The new book is Program or Be Programmed, 10 Commands for a Digital Age. You can read an excerpt at our website, see the 10 commands there, and link to the book, I think, as well. Doug Rushkoff, thank you so much for being with us today. We're really grateful. Thanks for your time.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for what you do.
Douglas Rushkoff, listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.